This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. Robin Dow is producing. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. And a reminder that our show re-airs, if you're listening in the morning, as you are, I'm sure, as we speak, but it re-airs at 9 p.m. Each night on WRKF, and podcasts are available at WRKF.org and at TalkLouisiana.org. We start with Nicholas Lemon. He's a New Orleanian. He's a graduate of Harvard University, went off to Cambridge when he was a teenager, somewhat like a former governor named Charles Elston Buddy Romer. Mm-hmm. And he has logged most of his life as a journalist on the East Coast at high levels, staff writer at The New Yorker, and he is the Dean Emeritus of the faculty of the School of Journalism at Columbia University's Graduate School. And he remains a professor of renown at that great university that's located, do they call it Morningside Heights or Harlem?
Yeah, Morningside Heights.
Yeah, and it is a place that's produced many luminaries, including Mark Ballard, who's with us every Thursday from The Advocate, who got his graduate degree at Columbia University. But as a young man, you headed off. You got out of the state, and you never came back, really, except for visits like this. Nick Lemon will be at the Claude Cook Center this afternoon at 4:30 discussing his passion, one of them, about civil rights and the Supreme Court. He's become quite an authority on this. 4:30 this afternoon at the Lod Cook Center at LSU. But when you were a young man, you decided to go off to Harvard University, the great opportunity. Can't blame you for doing that, but that's a big step for a kid from New Orleans.
Well, it wasn't that big a step, but yes, I guess I started being a journalist at a very young age, and I don't know if you remember, there was a wonderful alt-weekly in New Orleans called the Vieux Carré Courier. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that?
I do remember it, yes.
It doesn't exist anymore, sadly. And there was actually a second alt-weekly that was great called Figaro that doesn't exist, and then a third alt-weekly that still exists called Gambit. So that was kind of an interesting scene. And I started writing for The Courier when I was still in high school and loved doing it. But at the time, the local dailies were not great. Then they went through a period of real flourishing. And then they went into decline, and maybe now they're getting revived again. But this was in the days when, you know, there was a New Orleans States item in the afternoon and New Orleans Times-Picayune in the morning. And the Times-Picayune was later became a wonderful paper, but was not at the time. So I felt like if I wanted to be a journalist, I'd have to go somewhere else.
And you went off and became the president of the Harvard Crimson, a notable publication. Mm-hmm. And we have fewer newspapers now, and we certainly have fewer alt-weeklies. And Gambit, the one you mentioned that's still around, is a good newspaper, but it's owned by the mainstream Advocate-Picayune now. Yeah. So I don't think it could really accurately be called an alternative newspaper anymore.
Yeah, that's fair. They were never as alternative as we were. The Courier started as a cause publication to fight the proposed construction of a riverfront expressway in New Orleans. It was founded by preservationists. And, you know, it's funny, you hear this now and you think, how could anybody have thought it was a good idea to build an interstate highway right on the bank of the river in front of Jackson Square and so on? But somebody did. And so there were a lot of people trying to fight it, and they decided to start a weekly newspaper. And then it sort of morphed, that impulse joined with the 60s, and it became kind of an alt-weekly, and then was sold to Philip Carter, son of the legendary Hodden Carter of the Greenville, Mississippi Delta Democrat Times. And then, you know, he owned it for a few years, and then it sort of struggled and died.
Nicholas Lemon is with us. He's logged the last 36 years in New York City, the center of the universe, as my dear friend Gus Weil used to say. He spent many years of his life there. But New York City is a city that produced a president of the United States, and he is roundly disliked in his hometown. It's hard to believe, but Donald Trump, who some people view as the quintessential New Yorker, New York City guy, he got about 10% of the vote in his hometown.
Right.
So it's really not reflective of America, is it?
New York City. No, it's not. I mean, certainly where I live, it is not reflective of America. For example, I don't want to get too personal, but you probably have met people in your day-to-day life who have voted for President Trump.
Yes, I meet them quite regularly.
Okay, so that doesn't happen if you live on the Upper West Side of New York. It's a complete abstract concept. And you know, I have some friends when I go home to visit, and they know that, you know, I come from Trump country and some of my family are Trump voters. And I have one friend in particular who said, well, when you go down there, I want you to give them the facts, and then they'll change their mind about who they support politically. And I say to this friend, whose name is Gary, no, you don't know these, my family. That's not going to happen. But there's just this sense that it's impossible for people in my neighborhood to understand why someone would vote for Donald Trump.
And it is interesting how Trump, who is not a NASCAR guy, he's not a rodeo guy, he's not a hunter, he's not a fisherman, but yet people in the South who do those things and enjoy them immensely have latched on to him, and he, by virtue of the fact that he knows where the votes are, he comes and talks with them regularly, but he is a New Yorker, but he's not liked where he's known best, and he is liked where he's known least.
Yeah, and he has a lot of natural political talent that, you know, I've been out over the summer doing a lot of political reporting for The New Yorker, and one person said to me, when you watch Donald Trump at a rally, you can tell that he has the ability to basically conduct a focus group in real time. He senses what's landing and what's not landing, and he just kind of dials up what's landing and dials down what's not landing, and he can micro-adjust, which great politicians know how to do. And he's really, really good. I mean, just like you were saying, he figured out a way to tap into the consciousness of people who aren't like him in a really powerful way that really resonates. And it's an interesting phenomenon.
One we have not seen, nor will we most likely see after him. There'll be Trump imitators.
Well, but I mean, here in Louisiana, you know, oddly, the name that comes to mind is Huey Long.
I know what you're saying. I know exactly what you're saying.
You know, he really, really connected. I mean, we're both old enough to remember when anybody named Long. Huey Long was assassinated in 1935. Mm-hmm. For 40, 50 years, anybody whose name was Long on any ballot in Louisiana had, if they weren't an assured winner, they had a big leg up just because he was so revered. And, you know, he just connected. He tapped into something.
Well, American politics has evolved, and so has journalism. And as I stated, there are fewer journalists, there are fewer entities to report, but yet at the same time, there are phones that make everybody, in a sense, a journalist. How has that changed the landscape?
It's changed the landscape incredibly. I mean, journalism is just so different from when I started. I guess there's a lot of people out there who don't like journalists. So the collapse of parts of journalism has not been seen as a tragedy by 100% of the American population. But to me, the saddest part of it is, you know, if you went back, it's not that long ago, 1995, you had, you know, two or three papers that were kind of national newspapers. And I'm thinking of, you know, the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, those kinds of papers. And they're still really going strong. One level down, you had an incredible number of great, really great metro papers that had big newsrooms who were doing great reporting, including the Times-Picayune and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and the Houston Chronicle and the Dallas Morning News mm-hmm. and the LA Times. That area is just devastated in American journalism. All those papers, for various reasons, are, you know, at least in terms of who's in the newsroom, much, much smaller than they used to be. And so there's less reporting on what's going on in all those places. And it's been disheartening to watch that happen.
877-217-5757, your Talk Louisiana number. We'll return with Nicholas Lemon after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us. The Dean Emeritus of the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, Nicholas Lemon, is in the house. 877-217-5757. Native of New Orleans, graduate of Country Day School and Harvard University, and he has been reporting at high levels of American journalism for more than a generation. Staff writer at The New Yorker, going back to the 20th century, and was elected to the American Philosophical Society in 2022. He'll be speaking at Louisiana State University's Lod Cook Center this afternoon at 4:30 on civil rights in the Supreme Court, and certainly we will get to that, but must be something in the water in New Orleans. My former classmate, Alex Martin, is the news editor of the Wall Street Journal. Dean Baquet was editor of the New York Times until yep. very recently, another New Orleanian, and we have the city's produced Walter Isaacson and
Michael Lewis,
both of whom went to Newman, I believe.
Yep.
So it is a city that's produced all these journalists, and they were all born in the 50s and 60s, which is interesting too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know
actually,
what was
all born in the 50s.
Yeah, I don't know what was in the water exactly, but you know, New Orleans is such a fascinating place, and you grow up, I don't know, just seeing a lot of life there mm-hmm. and learning how to tell stories and so on. Maybe that has something to do with it.
Well, and I think, and I moved when I was 9, but in those 9 years, I experienced people from all over the world. It's a cosmopolitan city, mm-hmm. and it is still a city unlike any other in Louisiana. Buddy Romer used to tell the story when he was governor. He was meeting with a Japanese consul, and he said, have you ever been to Louisiana? And he goes, never. He goes, have you been to New Orleans? Oh, many times.
Right, right.
So, but civil rights, which is something you're an authority on, and that will be the focus of your topic today. New Orleans has a history that's not very pleasant when it comes to that.
There are good moments and bad moments. You know, the late great Moon Landrieu, who just passed away.
Yeah.
He was a pioneer, and there've been a lot of other pioneers over time. You know, one of the things I'm going to talk about is I'll get to why in a minute, but I've had the occasion to really dig down into civil rights struggles in the 1950s in New Orleans. And maybe it won't come as a surprise to people, but there was a lot of resistance to civil rights. And you know, New Orleans sometimes likes to think of itself as a city that has, you know, a calmer racial climate than some places, but it wasn't so calm back then.
And at one time, it was the epicenter for slave trading.
That's absolutely true. So New Orleans had a slave market, which was not, you know, when you say slave market, you think about one place, but it had multiple locations. And it was the largest in the country. The reason for that was a couple things. First of all, transatlantic slave trade was banned in, I think, 1809. So the you know, horrible ships that did the Middle Passage from Africa, that had to stop. But meanwhile, the plantation business was booming, and particularly here, and particularly because of sugarcane, which was a relatively new crop at the time. It wasn't successfully grown in Louisiana until 1796, I think. So you had this big booming sugarcane business that was totally dependent on slavery, and there was a demand for slaves, for humans sold as property, and they had to be imported. So this phrase that everybody's heard, sold down the river, that was referring to slaves from the upper South who were being sold by slave traders down the river to the New Orleans slave market to populate the sugarcane plantations in the Louisiana Sugar Bowl, quite around where we're sitting right now.
877-217-5757 for Nicholas Lemon. We'll take a few calls before we part company with him, but Nicholas, who is the Dean Emeritus at Columbia's great journalism school, considered one of the top two or three in the world, he is at Lodcook 4:30 this afternoon. Now, on the Supreme Court, recently, a judge here in Baton Rouge, a federal judge, Shelley Dick, she threw out the congressional map that was drawn by the legislature, which is wildly gerrymandered with North Baton Rouge in the same district as the city of New Orleans, to try to put most of the black people in South Louisiana in one district by design, and to prevent Baton Rouge, which votes Democratic, from having a Democratic congressman.
Right.
Now, the Supreme Court said, we'll save this for another time. And so the elections are going on with these districts that are not really reflective of the state of Louisiana. Your thoughts?
Well, I guess my main thought is state legislative politics are incredibly important, and national political reporters like me tend not to pay enough attention to them. And one reason why they're so important is that state legislatures get to draw congressional districts. And in the current Supreme Court is the most politically conservative that we've had in a very long time, especially because of the three appointees that President Trump was able to get onto the court in just one term in office. And, you know, the eternal question in the Supreme Court is, are they ideological or are they process-oriented? So they always say they're process-oriented. So you have a lot of Republican state legislatures, conservative state legislatures, drawing congressional districts. There was a time when the Supreme Court would intervene in that and be more actively involved in voting cases. And now the Supreme Court is saying, well, we believe in deference to state government, so we're not going to get involved. And that's why you're seeing what you're seeing.
All right. Another listener, this is Holly in the Garden District here in Baton Rouge. She asks, and I think this is a legitimate observation, that we view civil rights as a racial issue, but some would view abortion as a civil rights issue. And that's certainly front and center. And the Supreme Court, as we know, has made a big statement.
It has made a big statement. So, you know, I should say civil rights is, whoever invented the term civil rights, and I don't know who that was, wasn't thinking specifically about race relations in the U.S. It became a kind of code for that. So when people talk about civil rights law, the civil rights movement, what they're really talking about, and this has been true going back to the 1940s, is the, you know, movement for racial justice. Abortion obviously has very different political alliances. You're right that if you want to interpret civil rights not in this way that it's been used for my whole lifetime, but literally, then you get this very hot-blooded, you know, argument between, is it about the rights of the unborn or is it about the rights of women to control their bodies? As you know, you don't get a lot of agreement on that. But you know, yes, mm-hmm. If you want to be literal, you could say it's a civil rights issue. Really, both sides mm-hmm. could say it's a civil rights issue. But I just say, the term civil rights is generally understood to be about race relations.
Let's slide Kevin in North Baton Rouge in before the break. Kevin, you're on with Nicholas Lemon. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. If I have enough time, I have two questions I want to ask him. Since he said about the river, you know, the people's slaves coming down from the river, people selling them in Louisiana, I want to ask him.
All right, you're fading on us, Kevin. Let's see if we can get you to a better spot. Try again. You want to ask him about the slave trading in the river? Go ahead.
Can you hear me now?
I can. Go ahead.
Yes, I want to know what did a white person feel during slavery and during Jim Crow in Louisiana, and why?
All right. Well, what was the perception of the white population then?
Yeah, so that's interesting. I would say during slavery, you know, the whole, well.
I tell you what, we do have to take a break, but okay. We will pick up.
I'll come back and talk Nicholas about Lemon. That. I have a lot of things.
A good question from Kevin. Your number, 877-217-5757. We're back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. Nicholas Lemon, one of the top journalists in our country, a New Orleanian who works for The New Yorker, one of the exceptional magazines that's been around for a while and continues to do extremely well in these times. He'll be at the Lott Cook Center at LSU this afternoon at 4:30 discussing civil rights in the Supreme Court, and he is a native of New Orleans. And Kevin in North Baton Rouge asked a question before we hit the break about the white population during slavery and Jim Crow. The white population largely embraced this. Why?
Well, so during slavery, I mean, the white South was overwhelmingly pro-slavery and pro-Jim Crow. They were popular among whites. And, you know, I've always been fascinated by sort of lonely voices that were against them, but most were for them. And you know, part of it was just self-interest, which is a big part of it. And then part of it is, you know, white people convinced themselves that slavery was, you know, biblically sanctioned and was a normal institution, and B, that God had ordered that the races be rank ordered, and that they were acting sort of in God's will. I'm going to give a little preview of what I'm going to talk about later today, because I went back for a number of reasons and found a lot of old papers from my grandfather, who was a prominent lawyer in Louisiana, who died in 1959. So in the height of the civil rights era, or before the height, he was a prominent lawyer who was the rare white person who was pro-civil rights. And so I read a lot of his correspondence on this. It's kind of amazing. He was a trustee of Dillard University, the HBC in New Orleans. And the president of Dillard, after the Brown v. Board of Education decision, the decision that struck down school segregation, came down in May of 1954, he asked my grandfather to form a group of prominent Southern lawyers who would support the decision. And my grandfather wrote a statement saying, "We must respect the rule of law." And he had a big Rolodex, and he wrote a bunch of law school deans all over the South, prominent lawyers, people he thought would sign such a statement, "We must comply with the Supreme Court decision." Out of all the letters he wrote, only two people agreed to sign the letter. And one of the two had recently moved to New York. And so,
really?
I didn't know this whole story, and I'll tell this story tonight or this afternoon at LSU. And he said, "Well, you know, if I'm going to issue this statement that the Southern legal establishment respects the rule of law, and only three people are willing to sign it, and one of them is me, and one of them lives in New York, I'm not going to even issue it because people will take the opposite of the message we intend."
And some would say the more things change, the more they stay the same all these years later. You mentioned you have difficulty finding people in New York City who voted for Donald Trump in his hometown. Well, in the Southeastern Conference, we have 11 states, and collectively those 11 states have produced more than half of the electoral votes that Donald Trump has received in two elections. And the South is Trump country. And so some believe that there's a racial aspect to his appeal. Is that fair, or is that way out of bounds?
Well, I would say this. So, you know, I've written a lot about this in my life, so I'm trying to sort of compress. In the period during and after the Civil War, the South hated the Republican Party because the Republican Party was the party of, you know, the other side in the Civil War and Reconstruction. And so it was deep, deep, deep loyalty to the Democratic Party. That's why in the days of Franklin Roosevelt, you had this kind of odd thing where the most liberal, probably, president in American history had the total loyalty of the Deep South. As soon as the Democratic Party started to embrace civil rights, the South started to defect. In 1948, Strom Thurmond ran for president as a third-party candidate, opposing of what, by our standards, a very mild plank in the Democratic Party platform endorsing civil rights. And he carried four Southern states. So, you know, by the time you got to the late 60s, early 70s, the Democratic Party had positioned itself as the pro-civil rights party, and the South was leeching away. Now, the places where that hasn't happened are as much, like Georgia, or the places with bigger black populations. So I would say very few people, at least publicly, will say, I'm white and I'm motivated as a voter by what's in the interest of the white race, and Donald Trump, you know, really presents himself that way. So it's not that on the surface, but it is definitely true that as the more the Democratic Party embraced the cause of black people, the less on board the white South was. And I would say the mega most important fact in American politics during my lifetime is the South's massive switch from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party, which upended everything.
Nicholas Lemon, he'll be at the Lod Cook Center this afternoon at 4:30. Ron Fauché, another great New Orleanian, is on deck, and he'll comment on some of these same matters, as he always does. Dan downtown, we won't be able to get to all of you for Nicholas Lemon, but he does promise to be back. Dan, you're on with Nicholas. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Yes, you mentioned the motivation for whites promoting slavery. What would be the motivation for blacks like Clarence Thomas and Senator Scott of South Carolina to promote the Republican anti-civil rights agenda?
Well, you know, there's a lot of armchair psychology about that. I would say that I'm going to give a favorable interpretation that Justice Thomas would himself give, which is, you know, in shorthand, there's sort of two great traditions in black America about how to deal with racism. One, we identify with W.E.B. Du Bois, and that's, you know, directly demanding inclusion. And the other, which we identify with Booker T. Washington, is self-reliance. Booker T. Washington, who I think Thomas would praise, you know, eagerly and openly, and has, basically believed that black America shouldn't ask for favors from white America, shouldn't ask for inclusion. He was willing to accept segregation, and his big point was teach black people to run their own lives, and in every sense, economically, educationally, etc. And Thomas, you know, sees himself as carrying out that tradition. Because there aren't that many black Republicans, the few that there are, you know, embraced by the Republican Party and promoted a lot as a way of demonstrating that it shouldn't be understood as a white supremacy party.
A final question from Mary Patricia Ray, who's in New Orleans today. She says, what do you think, Nicholas, about the trend towards, she says, content written by reporters that a few years ago would have been labeled as opinion or editorial, now being termed analysis.
Yeah, I don't like it that much. I mean, so there's really two things I want to highlight here. So one is, you know, the internet is a wonderful and miraculous thing. We journalists are not in a licensed profession. We're not lawyers or doctors. So pretty much anybody who wants to say they're a journalist can be a journalist, right? So in the internet age, many, many people are sort of citizen journalists or self-appointed journalists, and they sit at home, and they have, because we have freedom of speech, they have a wonderful ability to say what they think about everything. I'm a reporter, so to me, journalism is going out and talking to people and finding out what's going on and trying to get to the truth of things, even when it's elusive and difficult. And it takes a lot of work. So, you know, citizen journalists are just not set up to do that. But because there's so much citizen journalism and so much content online, and the online world is so hungry for content, news organizations have increasingly pushed their reporters to just throw their opinions out there too. You know, don't take forever. Don't spend a lot of our money going out on the road to talk to people and just post. So that ethic has really grown in journalism. So, you know, what we teach at Columbia Journalism School is how to be a reporter. And I hope and pray that our country will continue to realize how vital reporting is. One thing people don't realize is, you remember the Build Back Better bill that didn't pass?
I do.
That had, in its many trillions...
Oh, I know exactly where you're going with this.
Yeah, many trillions of dollars. I think $3 billion to support
local journalism.
Journalism, yeah. Based on reporting. And whether that'll happen or not, I don't know.
It's not in the revised bill, yeah. That was something that I'm amazed that local journalism entities didn't get on board and editorialize and say this is a great thing.
Senator Amy Klobuchar, who is the daughter of a journalist at the Minneapolis Star Tribune, is pushing for a different form of support for local reporting-based journalism. And I don't know if she'll get it, but she's been pushing pretty hard, and she's got bipartisan support.
Nicholas Lemon, as you can hear, he's a man of ideas, and he's been around the American scene for a couple of generations, works for The New Yorker, and is Dean Emeritus of the faculty at the Columbia University Journalism School today, 4:30, Lod Cook Center. He'll be there, and you can hear more from him, and we'll hear from another great journalist and pollster and political pundit, Ron Fauché, after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. It's always a pleasure to talk with Ron Fauché, former state lawmaker, and he started one of the top political journals in the country, Politics in... what was the name of it, Ron? I'm sorry, I'm reciting from memory.
Campaigns and Elections.
Campaigns and Elections. And that went on for a while, didn't it?
Well, it still is going.
But you were involved for a while.
Right, some years ago, but I was editor and publisher for about a dozen years.
And founder, if I remember right.
And no, not founder. It had already been founded some years ago. We expanded it some, but it had been around since 1980.
And people are, of course, enthused about politics and our previous guest, like you, logged his formative years in New Orleans and was talking about Louisiana and our evolution from a blue state to a red state. But presidential campaigns were indicative of where this state was going to go. And I look back to when I was a kid in the 60s. Those three presidential elections in the 60s were reflective of Louisiana being all over the place when it came to its politics. In 1960, we as a state voted for John Kennedy. In 1964, we voted for Barry Goldwater. And in 1968, we voted for George Wallace. Think about that.
Well, that was an important transition with the Civil Rights Movement. After the Civil War, Louisiana was a solid Democratic state. It voted for Franklin Roosevelt overwhelmingly, and then getting into the 50s, it actually voted Republican in 1956 with Dwight Eisenhower. But then it went back and, as you said, voted for Kennedy, then Goldwater, then George Wallace. Louisiana was actually a pretty good bellwether swing state for a while there.
Oh, yeah, from 72 to 04, every election.
Yeah, very much so.
And then it changed with Obama. Now,
exactly.
That was where I was going to start with you, but I felt Nick Lemon's comments were interesting regarding race and politics. But polling has changed because of cell phones, and the last few presidential elections have been off the mark. 2004, for example, John Kerry was even with George Bush, and Bush ended up winning by I wouldn't say comfortable margin. He won by 3 million votes, but he would have lost the election had he lost Ohio, which he almost did. But Kerry, on election day, was thought to be, by some, to be the winner. Then 2012, Romney and Obama, people forget this, they were neck and neck. Dick Morris predicted Romney was going to win on election day, and Obama ended up winning by 5 million votes. In 16, Hillary Clinton was thought to be a winner, and she was not. And in 20, Joe Biden won by 7 million votes, but polls indicated he would win by an even greater margin than he did. What's happened, Ron?
Well, a number of things have happened. Number one, as you've shifted polling from calling landlines to calling cell phones, and most polling interviews now are done with cell phones, they became more expensive, and pollsters had added requirements to make sure the samples were balanced. You also have in the public polls, and let's keep in mind there's a difference between private and public polls. The public polls are usually conducted as cheaply as possible, whereas the private polls, those polls for actual political candidates, tend to be better because they spend more money on them and make sure they get good samples. But I think what we've seen in the most recent years, and I thought in 2020 in particular with the Senate races, that a lot of polls have simply been underpolling Republicans. When you looked at the Senate races in 2020, for example, you find that very few polls overshot the Democratic numbers, but quite a few of them undershot the Republican numbers. And that's a problem, and some of it has to do with educational attainment. The Republican Party has moved more. Their support is higher now than it used to be among voters without college-educated voters, and Democrats more so among college-educated voters. When you do a normal poll and just let the sample shake out, you generally get more educated voters than the sample should have. And that's been a big part of it. And I think it's still a problem, frankly.
That is interesting. Can it be adjusted? Can pollsters?
Yes. Yes, it can be adjusted. You can set sample targets, which are, in effect saying, well, we're going to stop calling certain groups of people because they're now exceeding their quotas in a sample. But when you do that, it ups the cost of polling. And some of the polls that are being done are conducted either through automated calls or online samples. And sometimes those polls have more problems and you have to weight the various groups more vigorously.
Now, we have some elections coming. Let's start with the national midterms. Right now, Democrats feel some confidence that the Democratic Party will retain control of the Senate and may gain a seat or two. But based on what you just said, those polls may be misleading them. What do you think?
Well, they could be. Of course, we don't know until election day, but you know, the thing about Senate races is in every election, there's always at least five or six U.S. Senate races that could legitimately go either way. And in the case like the current election, where you have an even Senate between Republicans and Democrats, anything could matter. And just all the Republicans need to do is have a net gain of one seat, and they pick up control of the Senate. And that's what a wave election is about. If those five or six races that are really close all end up moving to one side, then it's a wave. If you don't have a wave, it becomes sort of a one-by-one race where the Republicans win a few, the Democrats win a few. And in that particular case, it could end up being about the same as it is now.
And as you know, being the numbers guy you are, when you win one of those close ones, it's really like winning two, because instead of the other side being ahead, let's say 51-49, you're ahead 51-49 and go on from there. It's like baseball when you're trying to catch up in the standings. When you beat the team who's in front of you, you're gaining essentially two games rather than one, because a loss, of course, has the other impact, same impact as a win does. But in Louisiana, John Kennedy's running, and I would say, Ron, the odds of him retaining his seat are about 99.9%. Am I off target?
Well, I think that's about right. I think he will be reelected with votes to spare, and it is likely to be reelected in the primary and won't have to go into a runoff at this point. And I don't think that would be a surprise. What would be a surprise is if his opposition gets enough votes to throw him into a runoff. But I don't think that's likely at this point.
And he has a ton of money. I mean, unbelievable amount of money that he will not use all of it. He could take that money and save it for another election, or he could give it to somebody else. But there is now some talk about him running for governor, and I would think with his money and his popularity in Louisiana, he would be formidable. He will be 71 years old in November. Do you think one of our U.S. senators, Kennedy or Cassidy, or maybe even both, would have an interest in running for governor next year?
Well, it's very possible. You know, Senator Cassidy has publicly said that he is considering running for governor, and based on what I've heard, he's still considering it, and will make a decision probably sometime toward the end of the year. If Cassidy doesn't run, for example, and there's no other candidates getting in the race, there might be some pressure on Senator Kennedy to get into the race. And if either Cassidy or Kennedy got into the race, they would have a big impact on it, and and could be formidable candidates.
Now, I get these emails from Senator Kennedy, and he says, "What my team told me was borderline inhumane. This came yesterday. The news I heard has got me sweating like a sugar mill mule, and I'd honestly rather relive Biden's inauguration than get this talk again. My team sat me down, gave me a box of tissues, and told me the worst news I've heard in my entire life. Senator Kennedy, they started, we've got to tell you some bad news, and it's really important that you hear us. At this point, I was ready to hear the worst. I half expected them to tell me that Vladimir Lenin rose from the grave. What I heard was worse than I could have imagined. I could have lived my entire life on God's green earth without hearing this one. Senator Kennedy, we're not going to meet our general election projections." That's from John Neely Kennedy, senior senator from the great state of Louisiana, junior senator from the great state of Louisiana. He's raising money and doing it with a vengeance, Ron.
Well, that's the game everybody plays. You know, some time ago in politics, candidates like to talk about how strong they are.
Those days have gone. Signature support from First Financial and Jerry Lane. Stay tuned.